Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, our guest is a United Methodist theologian and ethicist, Stanley Harwas. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is the 2006 Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture, and he'll be speaking at 8 o'clock this evening on the U of I campus. This is an event that, of course, is open to anyone who is interested. You should feel welcome. This takes place at the auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. That's on the Urbana side of the campus on Gregory Avenue. Our guest currently is the Gilbert T. Rowe Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke Divinity School in Durham, North Carolina, and is well known as advocate of nonviolence and perhaps one of the best-known defenders of Christian pacifism, has written widely on this subject and others, and we're pleased to have him here with us this morning. The number, if you'd like to call in and get involved in the conversation as we proceed, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are welcome to call in and join us. Thanks very much for being here.
It's lovely to be here.
I have read you have said that as far as you're concerned, you have written that being a Christian and being a pacifist, not two different things, one thing. And the other thing that in this same essay, you write that you if you were not a Christian, you would not be a pacifist.
Probably.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit about that, because that is not something I think on which all Christians would agree, or at least they say that there are notable exceptions.
Obviously. I think, though, most Christians haven't thought about war one way or the other. Often when I go to give lectures in churches about the ethics of warfare, mm-hmm. and to try to present just war reflection as clearly as I can and as fairly as I can. And of course, I'm a pacifist, so I'm not a just warrior. Oftentimes, Christians will say, no one ever told me Christians have a problem with war. And I say, right, fire your bishop. That Christians in America have lost any sense that Christians only participate in war at great risk to their soul is one of the great tragedies of contemporary Christian life. I say I represent the Tonto principle of Christian ethics. The Lone Ranger and Tonto, and I'm aware now that a lot of people don't know who the Lone Ranger and Tonto are.
Well, I do.
That the Lone Ranger and Tonto once found themselves surrounded by 20,000 Sioux in the Dakotas. And the Lone Ranger looked over to Tonto and said, this looks pretty tough, Tonto. What do you think we ought to do? And he said, what do you mean, we, white man? Now, what I'm trying to do is to help Christians recover the Christian we from the American we. Mm. And that's very difficult.
So for those, because there have been Christian thinkers going back some time who have spent a lot of time developing some kind of justification for war, saying that there are certain circumstances under which we will say, yes, war is justified. So your argument is, sorry, in no case is war justified?
That's right. My way of putting it is that Christians are not called to nonviolence because we believe that nonviolence is a strategy to rid the world of war. But in a world of war, as faithful followers of Christ, we cannot imagine being anything other than nonviolent. So nonviolence is the naming of discipleship as constitutive of what it means to worship Jesus. And I think, therefore, that nonviolence, the kind of nonviolence. And I should say, I don't like the language of pacifism because it's just so passive. It also suggests it's a kind of position that you can name separate from your Christological convictions. I also don't like the language of nonviolence because who wants to represent something that's not? And so nonviolence indicates that you privilege the notion of violence. Peace is a deeper reality than violence. That's an Augustinian point that you only know evil parasitically on the good. So I represent Christian peacekeeping that is part of the essential practice of the church involved in the very worship of God. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sometimes ask Christians, do you think as you share the peace of Christ, which we do before we eat and drink our God, do you think as you share that peace that after you have been made participants in the body and blood of Christ, that one person can go over to one side of the church and pick up an AK-47, another person can go over to the other side of the church and pick up a Uzi and blow one another away in the name of nation states? Now, that's what we do. And insofar as that's what we do, I think it's not any wonder that people don't believe that Jesus Christ is Lord.
Is this your feeling that this is the path that Christians have to take? Is that where does that come from? Is that obviously it comes from the life of Jesus? But is that from does that come from what he said, or does it come from who he was?
Terrific question. Both, obviously. Mm-hmm. I don't think any one thing Jesus said will give you nonviolence. It's the cross. God refuses to redeem the world violently. So the cross is God's redeeming through the self-emptying of the Son, Philippians 2, to invite us into a way of life otherwise unimaginable. So I think that that reality is sure and makes it possible, therefore, for Christians to live differently than the world assumes. And what the world assumes is if you want justice, you better be ready to kill someone.
Our guest in this hour, Stanley Hauerwas. He's professor of theological ethics at the Duke University Divinity School, is a United Methodist theologian and ethicist, and is well known for his advocacy of Christian pacifism. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
I realize I didn't answer your question about where does Christian justification come from for making an exception. Actually, it's a very disputed issue about whether just war reflection, which people think begins with Augustine, and I think that there are problematic aspects to beginning it with Augustine. But the assumption is by some that just war, that is the attempt to develop discriminating criteria that will allow you to go to war in defense of the innocent. That is, just war is not self-defense. It is the defense of the innocent. And you only want to intervene as much as is necessary to prevent harm to the innocent. And all innocent means is that they did not deserve this attack. It must be by a public official, because you want to take the right of private vengeance away from individuals. And the the public official has a better chance of keeping the violence limited. And you can get a series of criteria. I'll be glad to display them if someone would like it spelled out. The question is whether that is necessary as a series of exceptions to the general stance of nonviolence. See, why would you even need to justify violence if you didn't have a stance of nonviolence? That's one way some people think just war is generated. But there is another justification of just war that says, no, war is not an exception to a general stance of nonviolence, but rather just war is about justice. And therefore, you should never want peace because war is a moral category that is necessary to achieve relative justice in a world that is generally without justice. So war is not an exception, but it is a moral reality in the world necessary to achieve the balances of power, of order in a world that is generally anarchical.
How did you personally come to this stand?
Very, very difficult. I'm classically educated, shaped by the work of Reinhold Niebuhr. And Reinhold Niebuhr was the determinative American theologian of the last century who taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And Reinhold Niebuhr had come out of Protestant liberalism, deeply shaped by the Protestant social gospel. And like so many, he had supported World War I. Indeed, he had tried to convince, he was out of the German Reformed, from Illinois, as a matter of fact. And he had tried to convince German evangelical Christians that they should participate in the war against Germany. People forget that a lot of Germans did not want to go to war against Germany. But then after World War I, he had become, he was so disappointed in the outcome, he had become what is known as a liberal pacifist. And liberal pacifism more or less says war is so stupid, it doesn't ever achieve its ends. It's got to be some kind of mistake, and we can overcome war if we just get better educated, we get better economic relations and this kind of thing. He then, he was in a pastorate in Detroit and was increasingly drawn into the labor struggles and shaped also by Marxist thought. And he began to see that violence, if you want justice, violence, you better be ready to use. And he wrote a famous book called Moral Man and Moral Society that just argued that, look, societies do not have and should not have the moral capability of self-sacrifice. And so he therefore gave a justification for the Christian use of violence as inevitable in a sinful world. You're going to, if you use it, you're going to be, you know, sinful, but you should do it. He himself underwrote what is basically what is known as a realist understanding of the necessity of war. He didn't articulate a just war perspective at all. But that was basically the perspective out of which I was educated. It was through the encounter of the work of an extraordinary theologian named John Howard Yoder that convinced me that Christian nonviolence is not an option. I mean, it's not something that, you know,
you can't choose.
And John Howard Yoder wrote an extraordinary book called The Politics of Jesus. I need to say he was a Mennonite, but when you say that, it sounds people immediately say, oh, yes, those people that withdraw from society. But Yoder was anything but someone that withdrew from society. I mean, he wrote The Christian Witness to the State, which was an argument that Reinhold Niebuhr had criticized liberal pacifism, but he said, well, you know, the kind of pacifism that's represented by the Anabaptists, it's useful to have them around to remind the rest of us what terrible people we are, but of course they're politically irresponsible. They just got, you know, they're farmers. They don't, you know, they don't get involved. Mm-hmm. And Yoder was dead set against that. I mean, he wanted you to be representing Christian nonviolence, to be extraordinarily involved in the challenge to the state of its violence.
Mm. Well, and certainly there are a lot of Mennonites who are still carrying on in that tradition today, who feel that it's very important to be socially engaged and take seriously the idea that they are at one of the traditional peace churches, and that doesn't just mean go to your house and close the door and be peaceful there.
Right. Absolutely not. No, right. Absolutely not. Indeed, they are. I have a poster on my door at school that is from the Mennonite Central Committee that shows two anguished people hugging one another, and the kind of statement on the poster says, "A modest proposal for peace. Let the Christians of the world resolve not to kill one another." And I have people that knock on my door all the time and say, that makes me so mad. And I say, why? And they say, well, Christians shouldn't kill anyone. I say, the Mennonites call it a modest proposal. You've got to begin somewhere. Now, that's a politics. I mean, ask yourself, what would it mean for Christians to resolve not to be drawn into ways of life that would force them to kill one another in the name of nation states? I mean, that's an extraordinary political challenge to the way the world is. And that's what the Mennonites are trying to live out. And to, I mean, when Christians kill other Christians, it's not murder, it's suicide. Mm. We're killing ourselves. And the Mennonites are trying to help us name that.
We have a caller who's been patient here, and we'll get them into the conversation right now. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I feel like, first of all, I'd like to preface my comment by saying that there should always be a place for the voice of the pacifist. But I have to say, you know, your philosophy has the benefit of time and place. I mean, you're in a relatively peaceful time. The world is not at war generally. And you're in the country that has the biggest military umbrella in the world to protect you. I mean, try to make your same argument in Poland in 1939 as the Nazis sweep in. I mean, to not, you know, fight for freedom in that position is to be a treasonous. How say you?
What about Hitler? there's a wonderful new book coming out from Brazos Press written by Robert Brimlow called What About Hitler? And I highly commend it to you. First of all, who fought in Hitler's armies? Lutherans and Catholics. If it hadn't been for Christian accommodation to the state, Hitler could not have done what Hitler wanted to do. Secondly, Christian presumption that the Jews are not the promised people are part and parcel of the accommodation of Christianity to the Nazi state. So, I'm asking, who knows what any of us would have done in Poland in 1938? I probably would have been a natural-born killer. I'm a Texan. But you and I don't live in 1938. We live in 2006. We're part, as Christians, of an imperial power that is wreaking its havoc around the world in an extraordinary display of cynical imposition of our will as the world. So,
can I say something now?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know where in your philosophy it says that freedom is for the white Western man only. But I say anybody who's willing to stand up and say that a dictator cannot oppress these people forever is not a cynical person. And history will rule this out. Like Ronald Reagan stood up and said, regardless of what it takes, we are going to destroy this evil of communism. And if it means sacrificing the blood of our young men so that the future can be a free future, then that's all right.
Are you ready
I'll
to
hang up and let you comment there.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready to invade China? I mean, if you think a rock is small, potatoes. If you're interested in regime change for freedom, invade China. I mean, that kind of logic seems to me unlimited in terms of the kind of presumptions about America being the force for freedom in the world, and therefore we must, as a matter of fact, achieve it in order that the whole world be at peace. Well, ask the rest of the world what they think about that narrative.
I'm sure that whenever you get into these kind of conversations that people raise, there are some people that raise the very questions that the caller raises,
right.
and say that talking about pacifism is all well and good as a kind of ideal, but let's get real about the way the world is. And after all, there are those who threaten the United States, and how do we respond to that threat?
Who's the we? I've already told you, I'm Tonto. The presumption that Christianity has a stake in America in order to be Christian is part of the problem. So what are we to do? I mean, the problem is, for example, at the start of the first Iraqi war, when George Bush Sr. said we must oppose naked aggression wherever it occurs around the world, Christians assumed that we was us. I'm trying to help Christians recover a sense that that we isn't us, that we have a different narrative, and we have a different understanding of freedom. I mean, it's not at all clear to me that what Americans mean by freedom is freedom at all. Freedom for Christians is perfect obedience. It is not, I get to choose. My way of putting it is modernity is the time that produces people that believe they should have no story except the story they chose when they had no story. That's what most people mean by freedom in America. I get to make up my own mind. Which then produces Christians who will say things like, well, I believe Jesus is my Lord and Savior, but that's just my personal opinion. Well, that's just stupid. But freedom produces that. Freedom produces that corrupt account of freedom produces that. And that we want the rest of the world to have that same kind of freedom. Look, I tell my students when I teach, I don't teach in a manner that allows them to make up their own mind. Because they don't have minds worth making up until I train them. The very idea that any teacher that has ever made up a syllabus knows you're not letting your students make up their own mind if they're doing their job well. So the very idea that America has some kind of special understanding of freedom that we want to share around the world is just a capitalist set of presumptions that says freedom is walking into Circuit City and trying to decide whether I'm going to buy a Sony or a Panasonic. That's not freedom. I mean, that's just as a matter of fact to be determined to be a consumer.
Yeah. Let me take a moment here to introduce again our guest,
And then we have a number of callers, and we'll get right back to the people on the phones. Also, just a quick note on the weather. I want to mention once again that the National Weather Service in Lincoln a little earlier this morning issued a flash flood warning for Macon County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 1 o'clock this afternoon. There is a possibility of some heavy rain producing flooding in a number of these areas, and including places like Decatur, Argenta, Forsyth, Macon, Mount Zion, Oriana, Warrensburg, just to name a few of these places. Sheriff's Office in Decatur earlier reported some flooding of county roads in the northern and southern parts of the county. Flooding is imminent or occurring, and if you're in this area, you should move to higher ground. If you live along a stream or a creek, take immediate precautions, and really important, don't try to cross swiftly moving water on foot or in an automobile. A lot of people get into trouble that way in these situations. I'll keep you informed on what's going on the weather. The next comprehensive look at the weather will be as part of the afternoon magazine, 12:35. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stanley Hauerwas. He is Gilbert T. Rowe Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke University Divinity School. It is well known as an advocate of Christian pacifism. He is here on the campus to give the Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. This is sponsored by the Program for the Study of Religion. He will be speaking on the topic, Sacrificing the Sacrifices of War. The lecture tonight is at 8 o'clock in the Spurlock Museum Auditorium on South Gregory in Urbana. And anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome to stop by. And we're pleased to have him here as well. Questions are welcome, too, and we have a number of people who now want to weigh in on the topic, and we'll get in as many as we can in our second here half of the program, starting in with someone who is listening in Kankakee, and this is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
The President of the United States is involved in using the military forces of the United States to engage in several overseas military adventures. Does your pacifism suggest that the president should be impeached and that the people should, in the November elections, elect a House of Representatives willing to adopt articles of impeachment of the president of the United States? Or, if not, what does your pacifism suggest should be done with the president of the United States in view of his private personal military adventures? Thank you.
Well, my problem with that question is the assumption that George Bush is doing what the American people do not want done. And I think that fails to acknowledge the character of the American public after September the 11th, 2001. I think the Iraqi war is the result of the fateful words that were used after September the 11th, 2001. George Bush knew the American people were in mourning, a good position to be in. I mean, that we were in mourning is where we should have been, and that we were distraught. And he felt the need to give us hope. And so the words he used to give us hope were, "We are at war." Well, when he did that, he gave bin Laden exactly what bin Laden wanted. Up until he uttered those words, bin Laden was a murderer. When you said, "We are at war," you made bin Laden a warrior, honorable. Then, if you say you are at war, you've got to make it look like war. It's very hard to go to war against a bin Laden. He's a murderer. You need to arrest him. But you don't go to war. So we found a place to go to war, Afghanistan. But that wasn't sufficient. We still had to have another war. Because when you say you're at war against terror, it's unending. It's what the American people desperately need, unending war. Because how else do you ever get Americans to cooperate if we're not at war? America was in a funk after the end of the Cold War. All you had was the soap opera called Bill Clinton. So George Bush gave the American people what we want, unending war. So it is not clear to me that we don't, and you will catch from the way I put things, I'm no great admirer of George W. Bush. But to put the burden on him fails to see how easily the American people, because of our deep fear of what it means to live in a dangerous world, have given George Bush the legitimation to do what he has done. The only problem that the American people have is they want their wars quick, and they want their wars capable of American soldiers fighting them without American soldiers being killed. And so now they're really upset, but they're not upset that we're at war. They're upset that it's not working out the way they want it to successfully. And I mean, the Bush administration's incompetence in Iraq is just unbelievable, but I think they're going to get away with it. So I think that to demonize Bush puts the burden on that administration in a way that alleviates the moral responsibility of the American people for not, as a matter of fact, having a dissenting position against war.
All right, let's go on. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Well, that person changed their mind. Bloomington, Indiana, line number three. Hello.
Hi. There's a scripture in the Old Testament of the Bible, the 14th chapter of Genesis. In that 14th chapter of Genesis, there's a war in which the nephew of the patriarch Abraham is taken captive. And when Abraham learns that his nephew has been taken captive, he arms all of his servants, and he attacks the army which has captured his nephew. Now, the Bible says that Abraham and his armed servants attacked this army at night. He smote them, in the words of the Bible, and he pursued them almost to Damascus. In other words, he not only defeats them, he chases after them. But he recovers his nephew, and he also recovers a lot of loot. And the thing which makes this warfare seem to be sanctioned by God is the fact that a priest of God called Melchizedek meets Abraham on his return from his military victory, and this Melchizedek blesses Abraham. And furthermore, in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, Melchizedek is referred to as a virtual type of Christ. So it seems here that Abraham has taken military action that is certainly blessed of God. How do you comment, sir?
Well, people oftentimes use the Old Testament, and you've got to be very careful here to justify war. And you've got to be careful this way because there is the Christian reading of these matters that says, well, God was a fairly angry, nasty guy in the Old Testament, but now we have Jesus full of love and compassion, so we've left that Old Testament God behind. Is the classical heresy associated with Marcion and is intrinsically anti-Semitic. My reading of that is if you feel like you're Abraham and if you know there's a Melchizedek around, well, then go do it. Go do it. But if you're not Abraham and you don't have a Melchizedek, don't. If you think that the Holy War tradition in the Old Testament is, of course, God does the fighting. not Israel. I mean, that's when you get the famous account of among the judges, where, you know, they always have to discern. And usually they have too many troops, and they send them home, because if you have too many, then they'll say, God says, well, you'll say you did it rather than me. God gets to kill who God wants to kill. That's God's business, not ours. So I think that those kinds of justifications, first of all, you've got to read the Old Testament Christologically. You can't read it as a Christian, as if somehow or the other you can move directly from those texts without going through Jesus.
It seems to me that you're saying two things with which I disagree. First of all, that the God of the Old Testament is different from the God of the New Testament.
No, that's exactly what I didn't say.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, what you did say, however, is if you're Abraham, you have a... It seems to me that what had happened to Abraham is that a member of his family had been attacked and taken captive. If I'm Abraham, if we in the United States have been attacked and our family...
But you're not Abraham. You're not a Jew. You're an American. That's the point.
Well, I know.
That's what I say. I see the analogy doesn't work. The analogy doesn't work.
In other words, nobody can be Abraham but Abraham, even though...
That's right.
Our family has also been attacked.
That's right. You're not the promised people. Abraham's the promised people.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll have to disagree.
No, we won't. You're wrong.
Listen, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to, again, just very quickly introduce our guest, Stanley Harwas. He's professor of theological ethics at the Duke University Divinity School, and someone who is very, very well known for having written about and spoken about these matters, very well known as an advocate of Christian pacifism. Questions continue to be welcome. We'll take as many as we have time for. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Gibson City, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Very interesting. I am a Mennonite, first of all. And second of all, I also belong to Christian Peacemaker Team. I'm a reservist. And the reason why Christian Peacemaker Team got started was back in the 80s at a Mennonite World Conference in France. Ron Sider said that Christians should be willing to go out and promote peace and nonviolence with the same courage that soldiers go to war. And that's how Christian Peacemaker Teams got started. And I think that's where it is today, and unfortunately the general Christian world does not see it that way. It was started by Mennonites, Church of the Brethren, and Quakers, or friends as they called themselves. But it also, the first place they went to was Haiti. But anyway, different people from different denominations have joined Christian Peacemaker Teams. And I guess that's what I really would like to see, is the Christian community be brave enough to go out and promote peace and nonviolence as Jesus did. And as you know, Tom Fox was a Christian Peacemaker Team full-time in Iraq. And he's an example of what a Christian does. And he's one of my heroes, and it was very sad to see him go, but he did what he believed in. He walked as he thought Jesus would want him to walk. And I also want to say that there's another group of people in the Mennonite Church called Every Church of Peace Church. And one of the things that their slogan is, the church could turn the world towards peace if every church lived and taught as Jesus lived and taught. And I think that's what we forget as Christians, that Jesus lived and taught peace. And I think what happened was back in, I think, the 3rd century or whatever, I'm not very good at my history and remembering dates, but Constantine changed that all. And I just, it's been so interesting listening to you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight. And I guess to one of your first callers about 1938, I hope that if I lived then that I would have risked my life for peace and justice rather than war and vengeance. And thank you, and I'll just hang up.
The CPTers are, I think, an extraordinary imaginative response to conflict. Gene Stolfus is one of my great heroes, even though Christians don't have much stake in heroism. I think that the kind of training the CPTers get the way they simply, I mean, the witness in Hebron, the witness in Columbia, has just been extraordinary. And what, I mean, basically what they do is they go and put themselves between warring factions and say, can we fix you guys a meal? I mean, just to have people recognize one another as human beings. And I think that that witness is absolutely necessary. And when Ron gave that challenge and Gene took it up, was exactly the kind of imaginative response that we Christians so desperately need. One of the ways to think about that is, one of the things I'll be doing tonight, is I think that what Christian peacemaker teams are, when I say imaginative, we need to imagine a world without war. It's very hard to imagine a world without war because peace just sounds so damn boring. But peace is such a complex, everyday reality because nothing is more difficult than the everyday. And one of the problems with the peace churches is they think they have to be too nice. At the heart of peace is Matthew 18. If your brother or sister sins against you, you are to go and confront them. That's peace, because that is the way you get at conflicts rather than repress them. So churches that are to be peace churches are churches that have a healthy ability to sustain conflict across time. Because that's what our God is, after all. God, our God is the God of Israel and the God of Christ. That is a conflict across time that is not resolved or resolvable. Yet we're determined to stay in that conflict rather than trying to repress it. That's peace. That's peace. Ephesians 2.
This makes me think about the fact that I'm sure for a lot of Christians, you ask them about pacifism, obviously their model is Jesus. And the thing I think about is turning the other cheek. And some people think that pacifism is passive.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm a Methodist. Actually, I'm now an Anglican. I go to the Church of the Holy Family in Chapel Hill. But my background is Methodist, and I have very strong continuing Methodist convictions. And I say that now that I'm back among the Methodists, I have discovered that the Methodists have a conviction is that God is nice. And since we're a sanctificationist people, we think we ought to be nice too. So, and what that means is that Methodism is that form of Christianity that has turned passive-aggressive behavior into an art form. And passive-aggressive behavior is exactly the most violent. It's right up there with Southern civility. I mean, Southern civility is the most calculated form of cruelty the world has ever ever invented. But I think that exactly the idea that, you turn the other cheek, that's passive-aggressive behavior generally, thinking that, well, if I let them hit me, then they'll feel guilty and I will get what I want. Now, exactly what Jesus promises is if you turn the other cheek, it doesn't mean they're not going to hit that one too. So there is no account of Christian nonviolence that doesn't require you envision the possibility that you are those that you love or the innocent may have to suffer for your convictions. And it's not a subtle way of getting what you want, because that's just another form of violence.
I was trying to get a few more callers in, that time remains. Urbana, line two is next. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to commend WILL for having this man and for your call, your guest, for his comments on NICE. I have seen NICE in my church too, and it isn't nice at all. But I am interested in what kind of intellectual gymnastics people do to justify war in a Christian church. You know, the old way was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and the new way is to love your neighbor. And I just don't see how people who call themselves Christians in any way, shape, or form can justify war. And I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about that.
I think probably the way it's done is through the private-public distinction. Privately, I'm really committed to nonviolence. As an individual, I really am committed to nonviolence. But when it comes to the public arena, I'm really going to have to think from time to time, we're going to have to use violence to maintain relative order in the world as we know it. Now, the public-private distinction is exactly the distinction that is part of the legitimation of the liberal nation state, that is the emasculation of any serious Christian politics. So the very distinction has to be challenged. I had one of my colleagues when I taught at the University of Notre Dame, a wonderful man that taught Judaica, said that any religion that doesn't tell you what to do with your pots and pans and genitals cannot be interesting. Pots and pans is obviously economics, and genitals are genitals. The very fact that Christians have wanted to privatize sex, who can tell me what to do with my genitals? Well, we Christians do. That's public. Indeed, part of the whole task that I think is before Christians today is to challenge that distinction between the public and the private that legitimates the compromising of their lives when it comes to, quote, politics in a way that so they get to do what's necessary in so-called public life that they wouldn't do in their private lives. That's just absolutely destructive to any account of the moral life as a Christian.
I'm trying to do one more, maybe. Chicago, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello. I agree that peace is a noble cause, but I think unless you, attack the underlying causes of war, I think just, attacking war itself is never going to really solve the problem. And I think if you want to get an idea of what's necessary, I think you read the in the New Testament, the letter of St. James, chapter 4, where he gets to the underlying causes of conflict. And it has a lot to do with the, I think, the materialism, the hedonism, and, the sinfulness in society. And I don't think if you don't actually attack that and, convert society, you're always going to have wars. If you read chapter 4 of St. James, I think you'll get an idea of the root causes of war.
Yeah, in James, the root cause of war is greed. And when was the last time you had Christians talk seriously about greed? I think we talk about sex because we think we know when you get it wrong. But how would you know you're greedy? Two SUVs? I mean, the very ability to name greed as a power that shapes our lives is very important. and Americans are extraordinarily greedy, and we call it creativity and ambition. So we think it's commendable. So I'm all for attacking greed as part and parcel of an underlying reality of war. But the underlying reality of war is war, and so you need to attack it always directly.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have some callers we cannot take. But if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, you can hear more from our guest, Stanley Hauerwas. He'll be presenting the annual Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture, sponsored by the Program for the Study of Religion here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He'll be speaking on the topic, Sacrificing the Sacrifices of War. That's tonight at 8 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum Auditorium on South Gregory Avenue in Urbana. And anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Thanks very much.
Very welcome to be. It's good to be here.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Focus 580, our show also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Just before we go here, a quick mention that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Bruce Ackerman. He is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale, and we will be talking about a recent book that he's authored. It's titled Before the Next Attack: Preserving Civil Liberties in an Age of Terrorism. And in the second hour, we'll talk a little bit about some of the difficulties involved in regulating nanotechnology with a guest who is a professor of law and will be giving a talk here sponsored by the law school. So that's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. I always welcome your questions, comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll feature a conversation with poet and critic Edward Hirsch. He is the author of many books of poetry and several of prose. His prose books include, most recently, Poet